You know, at one point I asked you, I said, explain the sequences to me.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of, you know, you kind of balked, and, you know, you basically said, you know, you wouldn't understand it.
Well, or, I don't think I mean,
I shouldn't say that. I'm paraphrasing. I should not
okay.
say that. But I should have, let's just start it. Explain it to me. Like, when you...
I mean, you've asked me this question two times, and I thought I gave a pretty decent answer where I said, like, okay, look, it's just a bunch of essays about how to think and how to reason, where, like, a lot of the individual things are, like, kind of obvious after you point it out, but I had never seen anyone point out the specific thing in this, like, very, very clear way that makes it, like, really obvious why, like, this is the correct way to think, and it might be intuitively tempting to think otherwise, but, like, actually, that's not the way you should think if you want to end up believing true things.
Which is a great explanation. So now what I'd love for you to do is go to the next level where you explain to me, like, what are those things? Is there a particular essay?
Yeah.
So the last
two times you asked me this question, do you listen to these recordings at all? Like, I don't. Okay. The last two times you asked me this question, I gave conservation of expected evidence as an example, and but another example was, like, there was an essay called The Bottom Line, or another one called Irrational Argument, where there's this idea that, like, you shouldn't. Like, a lot of people have this idea of, like, a lot of people have this intuition that, like, you can, like, you have a position, and then as part of your goal as a reasoner is to, like, come up with arguments for your position. And actually, this is backwards. You want to use arguments to, you should be swayed by arguments to decide which position is right. And, like, after you've already decided which position you want to argue for, any further arguments you come up with after the fact are, like, causally inert in making your position more correct.
Do you remember the first essay you read?
Mm-hmm.
Remember the first one you read? What was it?
I don't remember the specific one, but, like, when I started reading what was the Overcoming Bias in, like, late 2007.
Oh, that's good. Okay, that's good. Let's see my coffee. Sure.
So late 2007. So that
the blog had been around for about a year.
Yeah. So actually, I might actually be able to pinpoint the first one I read if my memory is correct that I was linked. So in my memoir, I mentioned that, like, I thought I remembered being linked to it by Megan McArdle. Who was then writing as Jane Galt at Asymmetrical Information. And so it's like, I for the purpose of my memoir, I dug up the place where she had linked to it. So that might have been the start.
Might have been the start.
So August 2007.
August 2007. And as you go to this relatively new blog, Overcoming Bias, what do you think this is? Do you have context as she's pointing you to this?
I mean, so I actually had seen some of Yudkowsky's essays before that, but, like, just as one-off essays and not, like, following this blog that is updating almost every day. But, like, he had written... he had written an FAQ about this was on his old, old site, an FAQ about the meaning of life, which was just a page arguing that, like, we need to get to the singularity. That's the only thing that matters. And, like, I guess this was a prominent enough webpage that I'd already seen it. I might not have also read, I'm trying to remember if I had already seen it at this time, but, like, he also had the Introduction to Bayesian Reasoning, which...
Remember what your opinion is on the meaning of life.
I wasn't, like, I was already, like, broadly pro-transhumanist in the sense of, like, you know, rake her as well. So, like, I didn't, like, I wasn't, like, sold on his particular thesis about AI and the singularity, but, like, I was, like, generally positive on, like, yep, the future is going to be different. There's going to be technology is going to do wild stuff. It's probably going to be good.
So you read the meaning of life in that context, and you know, but don't buy into everything and say, mm-hmm. and then you discover overcoming bias.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think about the relationship between those two things at that point or at any?
I mean, No, so like the sequences like so I think it's better to think of them as separate. And like he even wrote an essay about in when Lesserong was new, there was like a temporary ban on like don't discuss AI singularity topics because like we're trying to found a new rationality website. And like it's a separate topic. And it turns out that these topics actually turn out to inform each other in, like, surprising ways. But, like, it's kind of better if you... I think it's better to read the sequences as just being about human rationality and not worry about the thing that indirectly inspired them.
All right, so let's come back to that, because I think that's a really interesting notion, and I get it. I think there might be something more complicated going on there, but we can get there. But you come to this blog, at that point, they're not called the sequences, right? It's just a blog,
yeah.
It's part of this one blog, and you feel like it was every day that he was posting. I'm going back.
Well, I mean, we can go back to the archives and check. And not literally every day, but like getting close to, like, yeah, like three times a week at least.
And other people posting too, most notably Robin Hans. Are you reading that too?
Yeah, but it wasn't like, if it were, and like nowadays it is just Robin Hansen's blog. But like at the time it was a group blog, and like Hansen's post didn't really grab me the same way. Like I read Hansen's post because they were there on this website that I'm like really into, but like Yudkowsky's multi times a week posting was what kept me coming back.
And can you articulate, you've done this before with me, but can you articulate further what it was that really grabbed you? And can you give examples of some parts about his voice, right?
Yeah.
As well as what he's saying.
Yeah, there's just really, really clearly explaining, you know, how to think and how, and like, I mean... I don't know how many times I can answer this question.
Well,
and like,
I know, but what I want to do. One more question before I get into what I want to do. The other thing is that these aren't necessarily in a particular order. What's interesting to me is if you go and you look at how these things have been packaged now, as the same,
yeah,
they're in a completely different order.
It's not completely different. So like, I mean, so like the, like the. The name sequences comes from the fact, comes from, there is kind of an order, like it's not, you know, I'm not sure if it's still online anymore, but at one point, like, another one of Yudkowsky's fans had, like, put together, so while they were being, and like, maybe it's been edited, but it doesn't show this anymore, but like, while they were being published, there was, like, at the top of the post, there would be a, you know, follow-up to, and then link to previous posts. And, like, one of his other fans had, like, written a script to compile the directed acyclic graph of which posts are prerequisites to other posts. So, like, it's not, like, it's, so sequence is plural. It's not one strictly linear sequence, but there is, like, a dependency graph where, like, the final post, like, value is fragile, makes, it's not really going to make sense unless you've read the other 80,000 words. So, you know, there's the sequence on language, there's the sequence on morality, there's the sequence about evolution, and, like, I think, like, those particular topic sequences are kind of mostly in order, like...
Yeah, the topics are mostly in order, but they, you know, the way their package is now, they do ship a lot of stuff around. The very first one is from like 2008.
Yeah.
So that was kind of surprising. But yeah, you're right. The particular sequences seem to be longer. If you had to describe to people, like, you do a good job of saying, you know, teaching you how to think.
Mm-hmm.
Are there, like, three major lessons, three or four major lessons on how to think that you feel like are the top level things?
I mean, again, the bottom line thing, one thing that I just mentioned a few minutes ago, that is like, to me, that is like the central thing.
Why is that so important?
What?
Why is that so important?
Because, like, because it's like, again, there's this sort, just this sort of central flaw in human cognition where we, like, I mean, this is a little bit speculative, but, like, evolutionary psychologically, there's this idea that, like, a lot of our reasoning, a lot of what our reasoning is, like, designed to do is to, like, persuade other people to believe things that would benefit us if they believed them. And this is not actually the same thing as believing what is true. Like, I want other people, like, I want... If other people have artificially positive beliefs about me, they might treat me nicer. And so, like, people's cognition has been evolved to, with this warp, to, like, try to to self-deceive in order to deceive others. And, like, writing about evolution and evolutionary psychology and about, like, Bayesian reasoning, like, just, like, articulates this whole worldview where you can, like, instead of just being a human and, like, doing the things that everyone does without, like, without noticing, you have this, like, normative ideal of, like, here is how Bayesian decision theory works, and, like, contrasting the normative ideal with the way people naturally think is just, like, it's a very powerful idea, and, like, it's kind of sad that, like, I don't know, at the beginning... I think a lot of people had a lot more optimism, like, wow, this is revolutionary. We are going to be the second scientific revolution. This is life-changing. And it was life-changing for me, but, like, I don't think the rationality movement as having a mission to, like, promote sanity, I do not think we succeeded. Like, we published, like, we succeeded in a narrow sense that might be somewhat legible to New York Times readers, in the sense that, like, you know, we got a lot of money and adherence and published some books and we bought a hotel or whatever, but, like, that's not really success. Real success would be, like, having an art of cognition that is beyond what has been done before, and, like, I don't think that ever panned out. Like, again, the original essays are really good. I still believe those original essays, but there was this hope that, like, these original essays will, like, inspire more stuff like this. And, I mean, it inspired a little, but, like, people are still human. People are not, we have not figured out how to train people to be, like, Bayesian super cognitive masters. And, like, so, like, Yudkowsky will probably say that, like, he regards... So, I'm saying I think the Rationality Project has failed. Like, Yudkowsky would probably also say that it failed, but, like, I even, again, as I've written about elsewhere, I even think he got worse. Like, I don't think his recent stuff, I do not think measures up to the old stuff. And so, like, it's very sad.
Do you see any flaws in a world where everyone thinks that way?
I mean...
In one person thinks that
way. Be more specific about that way.
Well, one of the ways I think about this is... My interactions with people and communication with people...
Mm-hmm.
It involves a lot more than... You know, strict reasoning.
Yeah, sure.
You know, you can't, in my mind, reduce reduce the world to kind of ones and zeros.
Yeah, I mean, so again, the standard literature already addresses this point of that, like, when we're talking about this theoretical ideal of correct reasoning, it's not supposed to be a Stravolkin thing where you disregard emotions and disregard intuition, and because actually, like, emotions, and so because when we're talking about there's this vision of this, like, ideal mathematics of how reasoning should work, and, like, to the extent that human cognition works at all, it's because it, like, imperfectly mirrors the theoretical ideal. And so, like, things like emotion and intuition are not, like, opposed to reason, all of reason and emotion and intuition are, like, things that evolution bequeathed into us that, like, work insofar as they successfully process information. So, like, when you have emotion, like, when you have, like, you know, if someone seems sketchy and you're, like, kind of afraid, like, oh, maybe I should, like, steer clear of this person, they might be dangerous, you know, that's your brain performing Bayesian reasoning on, like, whatever pieces of evidence it like, goes into your implicit sketchiness computation. Like, it doesn't have to be like, ah, well, unless you can prove that they're sketchy, therefore you're being irrational. Like, that's not how it works. Well, as I said, I don't think we succeeded at creating an... Like, we don't know. This is a... Like, there's so much about psych... Okay, like, there are definitely people who study psychology and cognitive science at universities and elsewhere. There's still a lot people just don't really know and don't really understand. So how does it work? I don't know. I know a little bit from what I... You know, I've read a lot of books, but, like...
Maybe the lesson is you can't reduce human interaction and language to a set of rules. Maybe you can't do that.
Well, I mean... Just but okay. Here's another rational slogan. The map is not the territory. So, like, just because you don't know what the rules are doesn't mean there aren't rules. And, like, so, like, the actual rules might not be, like, a simple list. Sorry, rules is imprecise. The actual way things work might not be, and in fact almost certainly isn't going to be, like, a discrete list of, like, here are the fixed rules, but, like, there is some underlying reality that you can, like, that we don't quite grasp yet.
When you read this on Overcoming Bias, assuming you read it all the way to the end, so all the way through it's basically beginning of 2009.
Yeah.
And then Les Wrong was great. What do you remember about that? And how did that happen? And did you immediately move over?
Yeah. My Zach M. Davis Les Wrong account is actually a little bit newer because I was originally using ZM Davis because of the silly thing where, like, I wanted to use my initials as a name. That didn't pan out. But yeah. New website.
How did that work? Was there an announcement? Was there discussion?
Yeah, there was an announcement, like, we're making a new website for, you know, the Art of Rationality. And cuz, like, I mean I remember being at a meetup somewhere, and, like, I don't remember the details, but I remember, like, before, like, earlier in, like, either late 2008 or early 2009, I was at a meetup and they were talking about, like, we're going to make a new rationality website. And they mentioned it's going to be called Less Wrong. And I was like, oh, that's a good name. And then a few months later, we had a website.
And how frequent were these meetups? I mean, was it just, you know, a small group of people in the Bay Area, or were there other people in other parts of the world who were meeting up?
I don't know if there were other, because, you know, on meetup.com there was a Bay Area Overcoming Bias group, was probably the first one. Because,
right, okay.
Like, the very, very first one was, like, just announced on the blog itself in February 2008 in Millbrae. And then at some point someone made a meetup.com group and there were more.
I see. But how how big was that group and how often would you meet?
I don't think it was very regular. I think it was like I remember like later in 2008 there was Robin Hanson happened to be in town, so we had a meetup. Or like the Singularity Summit, 2008 Singularity Summit happened to be a thing and there was a meetup. So I think it was more opportunistic than regular at that point.
Describe one of them. What was it like?
I mean, I can probably dig up my diary entries of this, because like I always trust like the, you know, this was like
I'm a journalist in the same way, right?
Yeah, I do have some diary entries describing some 2008 meetups, and it's now been it was like. Has it really been 17 years? I guess it has.
Would Eliezer show up at these?
Yeah.
And and who else? And what was the relationship did you feel like between this kind of overcoming bias community and the Singularity Institute?
I mean, it's like the same people, basically, right? Okay. Like, I mean, so... Because, like, I mean... It was very important that like the rationality thing and the singularity thing, like there were like different projects, but like they're like to the people following Yudkowsky's writing were like very familiar with his views on both of these things. And like, you know, it was just sort of like, I don't know, probably the same if, I mean, I'll dig up the diary entries later, but like the, I mean, if you've been to like parties with Silicon Valley like geeks or whatever, like in 2025, like you probably get the idea. It's those same that kind of person, that kind of guy in 2008,
sitting around the table talking.
Yeah.
About these same ideas.
Yeah. But like, but as someone who had not, but like having spent my entire life in like California public schools, like just like having that intellectual environment where people are like really, really going deep on these ideas was like I'm used to it now, but like at the time it was like so revelatory, you know, just because like going to school is not the same intellectual experience as like talking to people who are actually interested in something and actually, you know, smarter than almost anyone at your school. At like one of the early meetups, like at one of the early meetups, I remember just like being so in awe of like this whole experience, this whole scene. Like I said out loud, like, this is surreal. And Eliezer Yudkowsky happened to be nearby and said to me, "Welcome to surreality," which is just his kind of sense of humor.
Got it. Got it. Do you remember who else was there? And do you remember like specific conversations?
I mean,
the one where you said it's surreal. Where do you think that was?
Just like the. I mean, it doesn't seem surreal now because, like, it became a community, and but like, compared to like your only intellectual experience being like alone with books or in school, like people actually having these like these really intense debates in real time was like, wow.
And the surreality meeting, where was that?
That was just his sense of like.
Where went physically?
Oh, this was. South Bay, I don't know if it was literally in Palo Alto, but somewhere in the South Bay, just someone's house.
Someone's house. Okay. Were these typically at somebody's house, or were they?
Yeah.
Would you have food?
Yeah. Someone put out party snacks, probably.
Do you get a sense of how the community grew? how quickly it grew. Like, it sounds like these meetups are, I don't know, 10 people?
I mean, maybe I think there were more like 30.
30? Okay, like 30 Bay Area people who are interested in this.
Yeah, I think that Harry Potter and the Methods became, like, contributed a lot to growth, and also, like, I'm sure you've heard the phrase Eternal September. So, like, growth, but, like, also, like, the people who came in later were maybe not, this is kind of a mean way to put it, but, like, not the same quality.
Were the meetups more frequent? Were they larger?
Yeah, it's because, you know, at some point, like, people started having, like, Berkeley meetups that were, like, more weekly. Yeah. And I'm sure that would also be the case in other cities. I don't know about that.
And it sounds like you're going to the Singularity summits.
I mean, I went to... I helped out with a couple of them. Like, I designed the programs for, like, the 2009 and 2010 summits. And I did a bunch of other chores for the 2010 summit. But then, like, a couple years later, they sold it to Ray Kurzweil's thing.
Why did that happen?
I don't know.
And were the same people who you're going to these meetups with, were most of them helping out with the summit and the like?
I mean, a few of them.
Yeah. So like Michael Vassar got involved during his time and helped.
Yeah, like, I remember being at a meetup in, like, 2008, and Michael had just become president of what was then the Singularity Institute. I remember, like, congratulating him on the presidency, and he, like... There was kind of this awkward moment where, like, I don't remember exactly what he said, but the general sentiment was, like, it doesn't feel quite appropriate to, like, congratulate someone on, like, acquiring a position the way you would at, like, a normal company. Because, like, if you're just working at a normal company for, like, money and status, and you get a promotion, and someone congratulates you, you're like, yes, I got a promotion, this is great. Whereas in this case, there was just more of an understanding that, like, actually, this isn't, like, a normal job. This is trying to do something about the most important event in future human history and, like, take stewardship over this incredibly enormous thing.
Right.
And, like, the congratulations on the presidency just doesn't seem like the right sentiment. And I don't remember exactly what he said. Whatever he said was much fewer words than that, but I think that was the vibe I got.
It's really interesting. Was this at a meetup?
This was a meetup.
Yeah. Okay. And he wasn't even living here, right? Wasn't he living in New York?
I don't know.
Okay. And the one, you know, you talk about is this, like, astronomical, like, task.
Yeah.
In another sense, like, it's this non-for-profit that has just a few employees.
Yeah.
And are you really building anything? It's unclear.
This is what we believed at the time, in retrospect. Like... In retrospect, some parts of it do seem to be kind of delusions of grandeur. But, like, nevertheless, like... See, this is the problem of, like, founding a niche, like, quasi-religion thing, philosophy thing, where, like, on the one hand, maybe some parts of it are, like, just completely delusion... Completely, utterly delusions of grandeur. But, like... I still... Separately from how sensible the, like, self-important parts were, I still do think that, like, the future of the universe will be dominated by artificial intelligence instead of biological humans. And that's, like, even if we got the details wrong, and even if we were, like, delusionally assigning, like, self-importance, like, this is our job, as opposed to something that, like, the global economy will do with or without us, like... I still think there was an important thing, even if a lot of the detail.
Can you speak with a bit lower voice? Because, you know, with my headphones.
Sorry.
I still hear you. Thank you.
So, What is the effect of it? Because it doesn't have a real effect on the AI movement and kind of the creation of everything we're seeing now. Don't you see that? Like,
yeah.
It created a group of people.
Yeah.
Like, how do you see that playing out?
I mean, it's hard to tell the... It would be really, there's, you don't know what would have happened otherwise. We can't see the counterfactual. So, it would be really interesting to know what the counterfactual, because, part of what makes the thing we were thinking then look kind of out of touch and delusional now is that, the actual technical innovations had nothing to do with us at all. Like, the deep learning, the stuff your book was about.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, that had nothing to do with us.
That's right.
But then, afterwards...
Right. Yeah, okay. Maybe if we can go back to that. But the other thing that interests me is that at the same time you've got kind of CIFAR.
Yeah.
And what's the relationship between CIFAR and what you guys are doing?
The original idea with CIFAR was that we're going to the rationality thing deserves given that the rationality thing and the singularity thing are separate, they're separate projects, we should have a separate organization that's just focused on rationality.
Okay. So this group that becomes interested in rationality through the sequences.
Yeah.
They say, okay, there's already a Singularity Institute. We need a
Yeah,
need
but
a
again, CIFAR. It's basically the same people in
same
that
people.
Like
Yeah. Okay. Got it.
So CIFAR CIFAR applied to become its own 501c3, but before the 501c3 got approved,
yeah.
The same people were working on this project as part of the Singularity Institute, you know?
Oh, I see. Okay, working on rationality.
Yeah.
Rationality. Okay, and then they did this.
They spun. It's the. They spun out a separate organization.
I see. And all these people came to this movement through overcoming bias, I guess.
I mean, probably.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's fascinating to me. So the other thing, I understand what you're saying.
But in terms of the same. So I think CIFAR's official co-founders are Anna Salomon,
yeah.
My friend,
yeah.
Who probably won't talk to you, Julie Galef,
yes.
And Andrew Critch, I think, is there,
yeah.
And
yeah.
But he, I think he's at Berkeley, but he does AI risk stuff, you know?
Yes, okay, got it, okay. So all three of those were three people who might show up at these meetups.
I think they were CIFAR's co-founders.
Yeah, yeah, but,
yeah.
But
they
would also show up at these meetups you're talking about,
yeah.
Where you're, it's an overcoming bias.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think I saw Julia much, but yeah.
Okay. Roughly $500. So, it's interesting what you said about Critch, right? So he's doing AI safety.
Yeah.
Now, and I understand what you're saying when you say that the AI stuff is separate from the rationality stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about less wrongs created. And
yeah.
So initially there was a ban on talking about this.
Briefly, for a month. It was because we're as part of launching the new website, let's
okay.
Hold off on the singularity stuff for a bit.
Okay. So the other thing, to me, I'm sure you've seen this. There's a post from Murkowski in 2003,
mm-hmm.
Where he says, okay, this Singularity Institute friendly AI thing is not progressing as quickly as I want. I don't have the people I need to build this thing. They just don't exist.
Uh-huh.
And he says, I have to create these people.
Yeah.
And he says, what I need to do is teach them to think rationally. That's what he says.
Yeah.
I mean, it's unbelievable. So then a few years go by, and he does exactly
that part kind of works.
I mean, how is it kind of? How is it?
Kind of relative to the grandiose expectations of
Okay. What I mean is, he said, I need to create a community who believes in this stuff.
That part worked.
And he did it. Okay? And this group, whether you can argue about how successful they were, they did start working on AI.
Yeah.
And and create this larger community that works on AI. Like, we now have a company, Anthropic,
yeah,
which is filled with people who think in a lot of the same ways.
Yeah.
Right? And they're working on this.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, it was successful. But I understand. But so it is separate, but it's not.
Right.
Like, he's thinking about these things in 2003 as feeding each other.
Yeah.
And they do. And then I kind of think about the rationality movement, and EA is the same way. Like, people say they're separate, and I get it. I get it. They are. At the same time, they're intertwined.
Yeah. I kind of think EA made rationality worse. Like, just that, like... I mean, so, like, the basic EA principles of, like, if you're going to think about how to do good, then you should, like, try to, like, think, like, how to use money, your money and your time most effectively to do the most good. Like, that part makes sense. But, like, in practice, EA, the movement, is not just about these neutral principles of how to do good that could apply anywhere. There's, like, this like central social network of, like, I mean, you might want some, one way to think about it is like lowercase effective altruism versus uppercase effective altruism, where, like, there's this particular social network of people who self-identify as EAs and, like, all talk to each other and network with each other, and, like, that part seems like kind of corrupting, in that, like, these people have this shared story about, like, we are the good people, and, like, really? Like, well, so, I mean, the tragic, and so, like, some of my friends, like Michael Vassar and Ben Hoffman, were, like, very critical of these trends, even in, like, 2017. And then, like, you know, a bit later in 2022, when FTX blew up, I sort of take that as, like, vindication of the things that Michael and Ben had been saying for 5 years, where there was this company that was, like, explicitly, you know, from the beginning, it was like, we're going to make money for EA. We're going to recruit EAs to our crypto company, which is good. And, like, we're going to make a lot of money for EA.
Yeah.
And then it turned out that, like, this company was a huge fraud.
What was Ben saying in those days?
I can send you the links, but he wrote a bunch of, like, very long, thoughtful essays about how, like,
back in 2017?
Yeah. About you know, like, in favor of lowercase effective altruism, thinking about how to do good, but, like, critical of the way that, like, EA in practice ends up being this, like, striver social network club of people, like, scheming to, like, support fellow EAs, which is not actually the most effective way to do good.
Yeah. It created a lot of money for the community, for AI work, AI safety work.
Yeah.
Was that a good thing in your mind?
I mean, maybe. Like, because, again, there's also this concern that, like the tragic thing about, like, uppercase EA is that, like, once you have this community of people self-identifying as, like, we are the good people, then there's this incentive to, like, sort of brand whatever you wanted to do anyway as, like, oh, this is an EA thing.
Right.
And, like, it just sort of becomes this, like, incestuous culture where, like, just because a project brands itself as, like, part of the EA community, is it actually effective? Well, maybe not. Maybe not. I think, and, like, the so-called rationalists also have this problem to some extent. I think it was a little bit less bad, but, like, still pretty bad, actually.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, like, I wrote that whole 80,000-word memoir complaining about how the rationalists, like, don't actually care about applying their own philosophy when it's politically inconvenient for them.
Right. Right. Does that show that, I don't know, the world is... again, more complicated than a set of rules, and that, you know, you,
that is not the moral I would draw. But like, so I, again, I do think the grandiose visions at the beginning of like, we're going to change the world, this is going to be great, like I do think the rationality movement has failed. Like, we did not achieve the grand methods of Bayesian reasoning that we thought. I think the movement has failed. I would not draw the sweeping philosophical conclusion of like, well, maybe there is no great, maybe the world can't be reduced to reason. Like, I think we failed, but like, I think this is a contingent fact about like the people we were and the resource, the people we were. This is a contingent fact about like flaws in people and flaws in human nature, rather than like a sweeping philosophical conclusion about the futility of reason. Like, I don't draw philosophical lessons from the failure. I draw like practical lessons about people.
Okay. Well, you know, a movement like this is ultimately about people, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's ultimately.
I mean, yes.
Yeah. But I hear what you're saying. And you know, you called it, what did you call it earlier? Quasi-religious? Like, how do you think of, like...
Well, sorry, I meant in, like, sorry, like... Again, this is why people don't want to talk to journalists. I shouldn't have called it a religion. But, okay, in all seriousness, the... Without believing in the supernatural, and in fact, like, having an essay in our literature that says, like, here's why supernatural things don't exist... It's kind of obviously filling the sociological niche of a religion, in that like there's a social group that believes things, that has like a canonical text about why the group believes those things. Like, you know, it's that kind of social grouping. So like, so psychologically and sociologically, it seems very comparable to a religion, even though I would say that like a lot of the beliefs are true.
Right.
And so when, as far as like the thing that I wrote that 80,000 word memoir about, where me and Michael and Ben and Jessica like sort of had this whole like, you know, petty drama about how we think Yudkowsky and Miri and Sifar have gone wrong. Like, you know, I do sometimes talk about that as being a religious civil war, in the sense that like it's just an apt description.
Fair enough. I mean, and, you know, just because you brought it up, like, this is why people don't want to talk to journalists. So what do you think about journalists that makes saying something like that dangerous? Why is that?
Because there's the fear that like, there's the, well, oh, that reminds, I still owe you, I never got around to it. I owe you an explanation of like why I thought your Slate Star Codex piece was like worse than the New Yorker pieces that I mentioned. I can't do it on the fly now because I would need to reread the pieces.
This part is recent. Yeah, you know what I mean?
But like basically there's this fear that like, like big publications like the New York Times or the Atlantic or something have a lot of power to like determine what people believe. And so like, you know, if I have my weird religion, like I'm just going to use the word religion in this context, you know, maybe I'm a Christian or a Zoroastrianist or whatever. If the New York Times says bad things about my religion, like that's dangerous for me.
It's interesting, though, that, you know, as I started working on that story, there were all these assumptions made about me and what I was trying to do that were patently wrong.
Yeah.
Like, what I really admire you sitting down and chatting with them.
Yeah.
We don't necessarily see the world the same way.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we can reach a point where we can discuss these things.
Yeah.
You can tell me when you think I'm wrong. And,
yeah.
And I can ask you questions. To me, that's how the world should work.
Yeah.
That's not the way it worked with that story. And there's
yeah.
sort of...
Well, so, but I...
To this point,
but like, I think... The fact that you wanted to publish Scott Alexander's name and Scott was not happy with that. Like, I think if it were, like, I think if you had granted him the pseudonymity, like, that whole thing would have gone very differently. Because remember, like, because, like, you know, he, because, you know, Scott is, like, you know, the number two writer in the subculture. Like, everyone reads Scott, everyone loves Scott, even though I've had my differences with him.
Sure.
But, like, the... You know, you were going to publish his last name. He flipped out and, like, again, deleted the blog. That was a big deal. Everyone is going to rally to his defense, you know?
Okay. Because he's the leader of...
Yeah.
A leader of the community.
Yeah.
You know, when it comes to... And feel free to push back on this. Like... What is true and what is not.
Uh-huh.
Okay. I was writing a story.
Uh-huh.
I didn't publish it.
Uh-huh.
He deletes his blog.
Yeah.
And everybody goes after me. I hadn't even published it.
Yeah.
When I did publish something,
uh-huh.
he'd already revealed his own name.
Yeah.
And they still accuse me of being the person
well, yeah.
who doxed it.
Well, no, I think that actually... But, like, the re... But, like... He didn't reveal, like, so there's this game theory thing, right? Where, like, the reason he revealed his name is because he knew that you were going to do so. So, like, if given that it was going to happen anyway, he'd rather it happen on his terms. But, like,
right.
It's still, like, game theoretically your fault, even if he published the name first.
Yeah, so it was my fault that I had an idea for a story, and I started... And my curiosity,
yeah,
which I would think is a
yeah.
you know, is looked on as a positive trait
yeah.
by the community. I'm trying to figure out what's going on here, and you know, this is the result. And the game theory is actually really interesting.
Mm.
Like, can you control the world through game theory? And
yeah, I mean
there. You know, there are extreme ramifications if you try to reduce everything to game theory, aren't there?
I mean, yeah, like, there's the question of, like, how to do game theory correctly.
Right.
So, like, and, like, this is a very deep philosophical topic that, yeah. like, the people we've been talking about have written a lot of words about, and, like, there's still a lot of unsettled issues.
Right, sure.
And a lot of misconceptions.
Right.
Where... There was that other story about the people who thought that decision theory implied they should kill their landlord. And I do not think that is correct decision theory.
So I was going to bring that up. Like, if you're talking to the layperson, someone who is not familiar with what's going on,
uh-huh.
how do you explain diseases to them? Is there like a succinct way to do it?
Just like... I don't...
No, I mean,
I don't know. I thought that the other journalists who covered that story, I thought some of them, like the Wired piece was very good.
Yeah.
The Guardian piece, who I spoke to that reporter, was very good.
Okay. All right. In your words, how would you explain
it? I don't know. Crazy people on the internet have weird ideas and take them to extremes. Like, it's not that interesting.
What's their relationship to your community?
Oh, I mean.
Why did this group spring up in your community?
I mean... because, again, the ideas of, like, rationality and saving the world, like, these are very powerful ideas. And, like, when you have powerful ideas and, like, young idealists who are maybe not quite as smart as the people who came up with the powerful ideas, like, they might... develop their own spin on it, and like extrapolate it in places that are not such a good idea.
Do you think there's a danger of extreme ideas like this? Because they're not an isolated example, right? Maybe they're the most extreme example, but we've got the SBF example.
Yeah.
We've got the leverage research example.
Yeah.
Is it fair that this...
It's a risk, but like, what I would say is that like there are risks both ways, in that on the one hand, like thinking for yourself and pursuing your philosophy wherever it takes you, even if it's an unconventional thing, like it can in fact go very wrong, as we've seen, but like refusing to think for yourself and just doing what your parents and schools want you to do, like that's definitely a lower variance path, but it's also like, okay, so if your only concern is to avoid anything bad happening, then just do what your parents and schools tell you to do. But so, like, okay, I'm using this word variance, you know what that means. So like, you can have good things, you can also have bad things. And so like, yeah, like just like, I do think that like, just doing what your parents and schools tell you to do, like, is not a great life. It's a lower variance life, but, like, it's... I think I'm doing much, much better for... Like, as many criticisms as I have of this whole thing, of this whole quasi-religion, it has changed me so much. I am doing so, so much better in life than if it hadn't been there. So, like, I am... So, like, for now, I am actually finishing college 15 years late, but like the way I'm doing it, like I'm proud of like, I think the way I'm doing it now makes so much more sense in that like, I learned how to study for my own reasons from my own books. And then, like, I'm now, like, applying all those skills I've gained in the intervening 15 years and, like, applying it to the standard school stuff. But, like, it's just a very different experience from, like, just being in school and just doing what the teachers tell you to do. And, like, that's your only experience of what it means to learn. As opposed to, like, okay, now that I've had some experience, like, trying to do things for myself and making some... mistakes along the way and trying to learn, like, I can take those skills and apply them to the standard curriculum and now, like, do better. As opposed to when I was at Santa Cruz 15 years ago, I was going to major in philosophy, like, I didn't have a purpose, I didn't have a plan, I didn't know anything about the world or how to think or how to do anything except sit in a class and do what the teacher tells you to do. It was a very impoverished existence. I think it was pretty bad. I think I'm doing much better in life now. I think I made more money. Like, I think my life is so much better for taking ideas seriously. And
what is it about the community in particular that enabled that?
Just like, on, they call it this part of Twitter. There's this slogan, you can just do things. And I think that, like, we didn't have that slogan at the time, but there was just this ethos of, like, you can just do things. And so, like, because I started studying math, like, so after I quit Santa Cruz, like, I started studying math from textbooks, because the overcoming bias comment section made that seem like a cool and important thing to do. That, like, these are mathy people. And, like, the idea that you can have... Because, you know, people are aware of... people have a concept of pleasure reading, where, like, you can read a book, not for school, but just because you want to read a book. Yeah. And, like, you can do that for other things, too.
Tell me about the comment section that overcoming bias... So thriving, it seems. Like,
yeah.
You know, same group of people.
Yeah.
Discussing these ideas in much the same way you discuss them at a meeting.
Yeah.
And that kind of empowers you.
Yeah.
To do that sort of thing. Does everybody use their real names? Did you know who these people were?
I mean, it was kind of mixed. Some people did, some people didn't.
How do you view the real name versus not real name thing?
I mean, it doesn't...
be a big part of the community, in a way.
I don't... It's not a big deal to me. Like, a lot of people use pseudonyms, and, like, it's fine. Like, I'm happy to, like... If someone writes a good post under a pseudonym, I'm happy to cite it, just to, like...
Okay. Why are people so concerned with using a pseudonym?
I mean, I think it's... I think, it, like... I don't know. Like, I think it's a... You know, different people... in different subcultures from different generations just relate to the internet differently. People have told me that, like, the fact that I use my real name for blog comments makes me seem older. So I think I just, like, sort of, like... So I was born in 1987. So I think I, like... I think I'm... I was born in this, like, very narrow window where, like, the pre-internet world is still real to me. Whereas I think maybe people who have always been online rather than just since age 10 or whatever, like, are used to screen names first. I don't know. I'm not sure.
Okay. Huh. But you think that, I don't know, the adherence to that is stronger in your community than in others?
I don't. I mean,
more of a general internet.
I think it's an internet thing. Like, certainly in my community, more so than, like, you know, people pitching pieces to the New York Times, but, like, compared to other internet communities, I think there's a lot of real names. Like, compared to, like, I don't know, like, Tumblr or DeviantArt or whatever.
And you said this part of Twitter? So is that, like, the rationality community?
I mean...
Twitter, is that what you mean?
Yeah, so, like, it's... I don't think, like... It's, like, mimetically downstream of the rationalist, but, like, it's a lot of other people. Like, it's not...
The other thing I was thinking about is, like, it's very easy to pick out someone from your community. There are certain phrases they use, for instance.
Uh-huh.
People talk about their epistemics.
Yeah.
Their priors.
It's a good... These are good... They're useful words.
Explain... Let's start with those words. What do they mean? I give the uninitiated. People don't understand.
Okay, so epistemology is the philosophical study of, like, how do we acquire knowledge? Like, again, this is a completely standard word, like, in philosophy. So, like, how the study of knowledge, how do you acquire knowledge, how do you know things?
So when you say my epistemics, what do you mean?
I mean, like...
How you acquired... A particular piece of knowledge?
Yeah, or, like, how do I think I know things? And so if I criticize someone saying that, like, they have bad epistemics, what that means is, like, I think they choose to believe things for bad reasons.
Bad reasons might those be?
So... I mean, so for, like, I mean, the first example that comes to mind is, like, kind of confounded with things and might not be the best example, but, like, one example, which, like, maybe I'll think of a better one later, is, like, trusting authority blindly. And so, like, whether, you know, maybe it's a religious authority, but, like, maybe it's, like, so, like, a particular field in academia which might not have the best standards. So, okay. So, sorry, I mentioned, like, because our society, like, we have our standard, you know, we have these universities that, like, grant degrees in a bunch of things, and, like, I think different fields are more or less trustworthy, partially due to, like, how easy it is to study the thing that they're trying to study, and also just the culture of that field. Is it healthy? Is it not healthy? So if you want to know something about physics, believing something that a physics PhD says, like, it's pretty trustworthy authority. Physics PhD, like, they tend to know their stuff. And then there's a bunch of other fields where, like, I do not think deferring to authority is such a great idea.
Right.
I mean, they know something. They certainly have to write a lot of papers in order to get the degree. But, like, there's this...
Right. Okay.
And so, like... And so if someone, like... I don't know. Oh, like, maybe a good example would, you know, the COVID pandemic. Like, in the early days of the pandemic, there was, like, there was all this sorts of, like, the left-right polarization of beliefs, like, switched sides. Because, like, at first, like, there were a bunch of people on the, like, in February 2020, there were a bunch of people, saying, like, oh, you know, we should, you know... stigmatizing Chinese people because of this virus is wrong. That's a real problem. And then later, like, being super cautious about the virus became a left-wing position. And so, like, if you have people who are, like, deferring to a political authority on questions that political authority doesn't really have a good reason to know something about, unlike physics PhDs, I would say that's bad epistemics.
Along those lines, don't people in the rationalist community kind of defer
yes.
their leaders?
It's a horrible problem.
On
yes.
subjects that they don't know about or are completely wrong about?
Yes, it's terrible. Sorry, again, I say the movement has failed. Yes, we have failed.
Just that irony, it just makes me, well...
No, that is a completely fair point. I absolutely touche.
But isn't that what's going on with this thing between Scott Alexander and me?
To a certain extent.
You know, like, you sent those links, and one of the interesting things to me is that people say, how dare he say this about X, Y, and Z? And then people say, we all know that Scott believes this stuff.
Yeah, exactly. That is kind of funny.
I mean, and the other thing that, like, amazes me. So I'm going through this this period where I'm trying to get the story out.
Yeah.
And it's not getting out. I'm getting all this pressure. And somebody sends me this thing about the Motte Bailey. Check this out. Uh-huh. So I read like Scott Alexander on the Motte Bailey argument. I'm like, come on, what is this nonsense? He completely does that.
Well, so when you say, what is this nonsense, do you mean, like, you disapprove of the idea, or you think that he does it too?
No, I thought, wow, this is pretty extreme. Like, I'm supposed to, like, take this blog post seriously, but I should have taken it seriously, because that's what he does.
Uh-huh.
That's exactly what he does. That's what he did when my story came out.
Uh-huh.
It's astounding. And uh-huh. It has power.
Yeah.
Do you see it that way?
I mean, like... I mean, like, I, like, I understand why Scott was so protective of his last name. Like, I don't know. It's an unfortunate thing. I have sympathy for Scott, like, being protective of his last name, but, like, the way the defensive cover up, where, like, you were like, no, Scott Alexander is a good person, and then other people are like, come on, it is kind of funny.
High Garden, did you ever go there? Did you know
I never went there.
Okay. When did you start going? Did you ever go to these winter solstice celebrations?
I was at I think the first one I was at was 2013.
What was that like?
I mean, it's sort of...
Was it at Chabot or was it somewhere else? Or?
This was before Chabot. This was at someone's house.
Okay.
I mean, it's just sort of like... Again, I used the phrase quasi-religion earlier. Right. This is like... It's kind of like a religious service where, like, you know, you have inspirational speeches, you have songs, there's a part where they turn the lights out, and then you, like, light candles, and then the lights come on. Like, it's just sort of a I mean, it's secular solstice service.
Right, right. And do they have set songs from the beginning?
I remember some of the songs from the 2013 ones are still being used.
Oh, interesting. Which ones?
So I remember, trying to remember. Tomorrow can be brighter than today, although the night is cold. The stars may seem so very far away.
Right.
So, it's...
Were there others you remember? Because some of them are about, singularity.
Yeah. Right. It's just sort of humanist and transhumanist themed songs about, reason and humanity will overcome the darkness. In a cold universe, we care about each other, that kind of sentiment.
Okay. Are there one or two others that you remember that were there in 2013 that are still there?
There's another one that's in 5,000 years, what you want to do, what you want to be. So,
yeah.
I mean, these are online, too.
Yeah. And so that was at somebody's house here in the Bay Area?
Yeah. I mean, it was a big house. Some rich person's house.
Famous people show up at this? Because in some cases, some known people showed up to one in New York.
I mean, probably not famous.
Okay. But I think the one in New York, was that 2013 too?
I don't know.
I don't know, what was the impetus for this? Or you were hooping it together?
I mean, I think Ray Arnold was probably the organizer.
Yeah, right. What's his story? Was he involved in the...
I mean, he's just been around for a while.
Okay.
I think he read Harry Potter and the Methods.
Oh, I see. Is he based in New York or based here?
I mean, he's here now.
Okay.
He works for Lightcone Infrastructure now.
Okay. And when was that organization created? And why was it called Lightcone?
Sorry, you don't already know that. Okay. So in special relativity, there's maximum distance. There's a maximum speed you can possibly go according to physics. And so when you draw the space-time diagram, the future that is actually accessible to us, it gets rendered as a cone. It would actually be four-dimensional, but it gets rendered as a cone. It's actually a...
Do you think, what I often think about is, I don't know if you've read this, but I've certainly heard it privately. Sam Altman will talk about OpenAI is going to collect a light cone of the world's wealth. Do you draw a straight line, from... your community talking about the light cone to him talking about the light cone?
I mean, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's probably where he got it from.
Do you get a sense of the relationship between him and the community and OpenAI and the community?
Is that
a mystery to you?
I don't know the details. I think it's very unfortunate because I don't think OpenAI is a good steward of the light cone.
But this is another thing that interests me, is that your community used to think OpenAI was okay, and then...
Yeah, well, so, that's...
And now, Sam Altman is the devil.
There was this... I mean, so, there was this thing... So this is another thing that, Michael and Ben were criticizing Eliezer and Nate and Miri over, was that, when OpenAI was first founded, Yudkowsky already thought it was a bad idea, a terrible idea. He reports, I'm sure this is on his Twitter somewhere, but he reports he cried when OpenAI was announced. And then publicly, Nate Soares on Miri's blog said something more... I don't remember, we can track down exactly what he said, but it was something we welcome a new entrance to the space. It said something vaguely positive sounding about OpenAI, even though he thought like the sentiment in our community was that open source AI is a bad idea. And so then OpenAI, like, it was originally pitched as, like, we're open source. And so, like, the original, there's this thing where, like, Nate, like, Soares and Yudkowsky privately thought OpenAI, as announced, was a bad idea, but they didn't feel, but there was so much, like, power and money behind this new thing, because, like, this was, like, downstream of the Puerto Rico conference about AI safety. Yeah. And so there was, like, so much, like, power and money behind this new thing that they didn't feel comfortable bad-mouthing it in public at the time.
And, yeah, I don't know, you think there's some revisionist history going on there? Maybe they're saying that they were concerned?
I believe it. I mean, it's reasonable to be suspicious, but, like...
Well, remind me the name of that rationalist summer camp that went on for a while. Where they were
Spark?
Spark, yeah, yeah. Do you know much about that?
I don't know much about that.
So that wasn't, you never attended or participated or helped out with?
No. Yeah, I'm sorry, like, I know all the people in my little subculture. I don't know any actual rich and famous people. I think Luke Nosek was at one of these parties. Who I think is rich for some reason that I don't remember.
Founders Fund.
Okay, yeah. I think I remember being at a party where like Luke Nosek and Yudkowsky were talking, and I was trying to participate in the same conversation circle, and they were both just ignoring me because I'm not important or something, I guess.
I mean, that alone is interesting. You know, it's interesting how Peter Thiel he made a big bet on this community. He funded it.
Uh-huh. I mean, I think by his scale, it was a small bet, right?
Well, yeah, but it's about the same amount of money he put into Facebook.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
It's interesting that he did it, right, at that time.
Yeah, I think I think his views have diverged by now. Like, there was that story where, like, he was advising Sam Altman, like, EAs are going to kill your company.
Pretty much what happened. Okay, just like to circle all the way back around.
Uh-huh.
Because I want to, you know, make sure I understand. Like I said, I think it's good for me to get inside the mindset.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take that one overcoming bias blog post.
Uh-huh.
That you think is so important. Can you walk me through it step by step? So you make sure I understand. Like, do you remember it?
Yeah, so like... I mean, I'd rather not do this live. Like, I'd rather just send you the link. Like,
okay.
Okay, I'm a lot. I'm a lot dumber in real time, I think.
Most of us are. Some people are. Yeah, some people aren't. Well, yeah. I mean, if you.
Because, you know, like, when I have to, when I'm, because what I love about, like, blogging is like. At blogging as opposed to real life conversations, like, when I have time to think for hours and days,
yeah.
Like, I can eventually come up with a much better argument than I could on the fly.
Well, I mean, if you've got time, I'd love to hear, you know, what you thought in detail of that, and let post and walk me through it.
Okay.
This was great as usual, thank you. So interesting.
I'm yeah, thanks.
Ultimately, like so many fascinating to think about. Somebody told me they think that I should go on to Less Wrong,
uh-huh.
And sort of announce myself and, you know, and I don't know, work through some of the
I mean, I would love to see that.
Okay.
I don't know if it's a good idea for your, like, I don't know if it would work for whatever you're trying to achieve.
Yeah, that's my question. Like, would it achieve it? Or would it just
I don't know.
What should I say?
Well, so, like, I mean, what goal are you trying to achieve? Like, I guess you're writing a book. So, I mean, last time I said, like, I don't think you're the right person to write this book because, like, as a journal, like, one of your prime resources is, like, people who know the thing who are willing to talk to you. In this particular case, like, your reputation has been poisoned as, like, people are not going to talk to you.
What I always say is, with any good story, some people are not going to talk to you.
Yeah.
And some people are.
Right, but like I think with this particular case, I think seems likely to be unusually bad.
Yeah, but like,
but
it's just,
no.
And people always talk.
Yeah,
I have.
I mean, like, I do. Like, again, I don't want to be mean, but like, I kind of expect Kevin Roos's book to be better than yours because, like, based on reading his writing, it seems like he gets it more.
Well, here's what's interesting. There's a difference. Well, what Kevin's going to do is he's going to deliver a book that is completely in line with your community's way of thinking.
Okay.
So that's different than it being better.
Right.
Fair. I think of it differently. Like, what Bruce does is he says, all right, I'm going to take this position. I'm just like, to me, the job of a journalist is to step back a little bit and look at everything and really explain to people what's going on.
Right.
This book will not do that. But, you know.
Yeah, it's hard to know what objectivity means.
Because
on the one hand, like... Yeah, because, like, there's, like... I think there's this worry about, like, both sides journalism where you just let sort of, like, quote one person who's supportive of a thing and quote another person who's opposed to the thing and just call it a day.
Yeah.
And that's... I think it's possible to do better than that. But, like, in attempting to do better, you might... In attempting to do better and, like, try to, like, compile all the facts and present everything you've compiled, like, maybe you're just end up packaging your own view, which is, like, yeah.
I get it. I definitely get it. All right. Well, I'll think that through, see if it's worth doing. But, yeah, you know, one person I'm talking to, they say, you have to do this. You know, I always get these ultimatums. Like, you have to.
Well, I mean.
Portray a confidence.
Yeah, but, like, I'm just wondering, what is the... Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I would love to say that just because, like, I have this ideological thing of I'm in favor of information flow and talking to people and, like, not... I definitely don't trust my in-group to be sane anymore. I think we failed.
See, that's a valid point of view that it will not be in Kevin's book. Right?
I mean...
You're not necessarily right, but it's a valid point of view.
But, like, would that... Should I talk to Kevin? Like, I don't know.
I mean, I'm just making a point. Right?
Yeah.
You know? I'm just making a point. I'm with you, and I believe in both those things, right?
Uh-huh.
So, good for you.
Thanks.